afternoon. My name is Laura Takashi, and I am a student project manager at the Clark Forum for Contemporary Issues. On behalf of the Clark Forum and the Office of Global Education, I'd like to welcome you to today's event, America's Role and Image in the World, a Latin American Perspective. We have with us today Geralberto Lopez Blanco, born and currently living in Havana, Cuba. Lopez is a journalist and a doctoral candidate in communication sciences at the University of Havana. He writes a weekly column on international economic affairs for Opciones, a weekly publication of Juventud Rebelde, one of three national newspapers in Cuba. His journalistic researches have taken him all over the world, including several times to the United States. He has authored many books, all in Spanish, including La Emigración Cubana en los Estados Unidos, Descorriendo Mamparas, Miami, Dinero Sucio, and Benedicción Cubana en Tierras Sudafricanas. His latest book, Las Mascotas de la Guerra, Oral Histories of Children in Nicaragua, who participated in the fight against the Contras in 1980s, was presented to the public during the 2011 Havana Book Fair. This presentation will begin with a 5-minute summary of Geralberto Lopez Blanche's address delivered by Mr. Lopez in Spanish, followed by a 20-minute English translation of the entire address by Professor Sinan Kunt. A question-and-answer session will follow the presentations with simultaneous translations by Professor Alberto Rodriguez, so please hold all questions until this time, or until that time. Now, please join me in welcoming Geralberto Lopez Blanche.
Thank you very much for your presence. In this moment, I can speak in English because it's very difficult to me. I don't practice for a long time my English. It's better that I read some a short write in Spanish. And after my friends, Sinan, read an essay in English. A lot of people know English, know Spanish. Yeah, it's possible. I try to read slowly because it's to try to understand. Rol e imagen de Estados Unidos en América Latina. La visión que actualmente tiene América Latina sobre el papel de Estados Unidos en esta región y en la arena internacional tiene diferentes matices según el gobierno que ejerce el poder, unos más ligados a Washington y otros que han ido dejando de esa antigua hegemonía. Las relaciones de Estados Unidos con la región se han basado en el uso de la fuerza como si ese fuera su traspatio, donde puede imponer su política sin el más mínimo apego a las leyes internacionales, enfocando a la región como un área de seguridad sin comprender los intereses propios de cada país a los cuales se les olvidaba ejercer su soberanía, se les invalidaba ejercer su soberanía e independencia. Cierto que Estados Unidos ha podido jugar ese rol en la región con la anuencia de alianzas con sectores políticos internos que lograron mantener gobiernos mediante políticas antidemocráticas respaldada por Washington. Como indiqué al principio, esa visión no es homogénea, porque aunque lleguen al poder gobiernos populares que laboren a favor de resolver necesidades básicas de sus habitantes, como por ejemplo Venezuela, Bolivia, Nicaragua, Ecuador, siempre existen sectores como donde el ideal sigue siendo Estados Unidos, es decir, venir hacia acá, así como ciudadanos de la región que migran hacia este enorme país para tratar de alcanzar el sueño americano y poder ayudar a sus familiares en el envío de remesas, como ocurre con muchos países de América Latina, El Salvador, México, que vienen hacia acá para buscar remesas y enviárselas a sus familiares. Pero en sentido general y sobre todo entre la mayoría de la población regional, la visión que tienen sobre Estados Unidos es bastante desfavorable y de poco crédito para el gigante del norte, debido en parte a que en los últimos años, con el impulso de las comunicaciones y de Internet, numerosos habitantes tienen acceso a informaciones más fidedignas que hablan sobre las acciones agresivas que Washington a lo largo de la historia ha desarrollado en este y en otros continentes, así como el surgimiento en el área de gobiernos nacionalistas que se esfuerzan por llevar adelante programas sociales en bien de sus habitantes. Por eso comprendo que el tema es bastante complejo, con muchas aristas en pro y en contra, y les propongo profundizar un poco en el tema. El rol desempeñado por Estados Unidos hacia América Latina tras obtener la independencia de Inglaterra en 1776, ha sido el de tratar de controlar política, militar y económicamente a toda la región con la utilización de cualquier método a su alcance. Primeramente extendió su territorio a expensas de México, al que le arrebató grandes extensiones como Texas, Nuevo México, Arizona, Utah, Nevada, Oregón, Colorado, Wyoming, California. Seguidamente fue extendiendo su poderío hacia toda América Latina, mediante imposición de gobiernos afines, penetración de grandes capitales para controlar la economía y, por ende, la política. Derrocamiento de presidentes no acordes a su política, como ha sucedido ahora recientemente también todavía en Honduras. Invasiones armadas para controlar o derrocar movimientos y gobiernos populares. Apoyo a dictaduras militares que sembraron el terror dentro de la población. Apoyo a los golpes de Estado. Al triunfar la Revolución Cubana, Estados Unidos vio en ella un mal mayor, pues desde los primeros momentos Cuba rechazó las directrices de Washington, al contrario de lo que hacían los demás países de la región. Cuba levantaba las banderas de la soberanía y la independencia política y económica, situación que Estados Unidos no podía permitir. A fin de evitar que el resto de América Latina siguiera su ejemplo, el presidente John F. Kennedy propuso en 1961 un programa de ayuda económica y social para la región denominado Alianza para el Progreso, que resultó años más tarde en un rotundo fracaso. A partir de los años 70, Washington puso en marcha otros planes para mantener el control hegemónico sobre la región. Unido a la introducción de políticas neoliberales, se sucedieron golpes de Estado para la implantación de dictaduras militares como fueron las de Brasil, Colombia, Chile, Argentina, Uruguay y las que ya tenían lugar en Haití, Paraguay y Nicaragua. A partir de 1991, al derrumbarse los Estados socialistas de Europa y sobre todo la antigua Unión Soviética, Estados Unidos se convirtió en la única potencia política, militar y económica del mundo. Y en la región latinoamericana continuó su penetración económica por medio de las compañías transnacionales y los tratados de libre comercio. De esto podemos después hablar mucho, es decir, si hacen preguntas podemos hablar mucho más sobre esta. Esto simplemente es un pequeño resumen. El objetivo era frenar el avance de la revolución, tanto cubana como la venezolana, y la influencia que tenían en América Latina, a la par de contrarrestar el impulso de programas y alianzas económicas y sociales surgidas en la región con la Alianza Bolivariana para los Pueblos de Nuestra América, que es el ALBA, el MERCOSUR, el Banco del Sur, PetroSUR, PetroCaribe, TELESUR, es decir, organizaciones que están trabajando a favor de estos pueblos. En la Cuarta Cumbre de las Américas, efectuada en Mar del Plata, Argentina, en noviembre de 2005, ocurrió un veraje hacia la política de sometimiento económico cuando la mayoría de los participantes rechazaron el proyecto estadounidense para la región denominado Área de Libre Comercio para las Américas, conocida por ALCA. Nuevas voces se alzaron a favor de alcanzar la independencia y soberanía política y económica de América Latina, que junto a Cuba comenzaron a dejarse oír en foros nacionales e internacionales en contra de las políticas neoliberales como Venezuela, Bolivia, Ecuador, Nicaragua, Argentina, Brasil, Uruguay y Paraguay y otras del Caribe. Varios gobiernos latinoamericanos han aumentado los programas de atención pública para la salud y la educación, se han reducido los índices de pobreza en países antes mencionados, y como Bolivia, ya los mencioné, y se hace necesario entonces que Estados Unidos reinicie una relación de amistad, con penetración y ayuda con las naciones latinoamericanas que hagan de este continente en su totalidad uno de los más democráticos, pacíficos y avanzados del mundo. Y pregunto, ¿será posible cambiar en Estados Unidos la mentalidad de América Latina como traspatio? ¿Será capaz de aceptar la existencia de gobiernos con intereses nacionales y propios? ¿Podrá aceptar el ejercicio de soberanía nacional de las naciones latinoamericanas? ¿Podrá cambiar su política de embargo hacia Cuba? ¿Controlará la fuga de cerebros latinoamericanos hacia Estados Unidos para que estos puedan ayudar al desarrollo de su país? Eso es todo. Muchas gracias.
Actually, the speech is not finished yet, so you can hold your applause. I'm going to read the full English translation, somewhat longer, but containing all of the things that Alberto already spoken Spanish. Okay. Latin America's current view of the United States' role in the region and the international arena differs from country to country. Some governments are more closely linked to Washington, and others have been disengaging themselves from the old U.S. hegemony. The relations between the United States and the region previously were based on the use of force, as if Latin America were the U.S. backyard, where it could impose its policies without the slightest regard for international law. The United States focused on the region as an area of security without understanding that it was invalidating the right of each country to assert its own sovereignty and independence. Clearly, the United States has been able to play this role in the region because it had compliant internal allies and politicians in various countries that maintained anti-democratic governments backed by Washington. As I pointed out at the beginning, this view is not homogeneous because even where popular governments have gained power and are working to meet the basic needs of their populations, such as in Venezuela, Bolivia, Nicaragua, Ecuador, there are always sectors where the ideal continues to be the United States. In addition, citizens throughout the whole region immigrate to this enormous country, trying to find the American dream and help their families back home by sending them money. But in a general sense, among the great majority of the population of the region, the view of the United States is quite unfavorable. The diminished regard for the giant of the North is due, in part, to the growing influence of the Internet and other means of communication in recent years. Now, many people have access to more reliable information. They hear about the aggressive actions that Washington, throughout its history, has initiated in this and other continents, and about the upsurge of nationalistic governments that are being empowered to carry forward social programs for the well-being of their citizens. Since I understand that the subject is very complex, with many angles, both pro and con, I propose that we discuss it a little more deeply. The role assumed by the United States towards Latin America, ever since it obtained its independence from England in 1776, has been to try to control the whole region politically, economically, and militarily, utilizing any method within its reach. First, it extended its territory at the expense of Mexico, from which it snatched an enormous area consisting of Texas, New Mexico, Arizona, Utah, Nevada, Oregon, Colorado, Wyoming, and California. In the years that followed, its power was extended throughout all Latin America by a variety of means. By the imposition of governments that sing in tune with Washington, by the penetration of giant capitalist enterprises that control entire economies, and consequently the political system, by overthrowing presidents who did not conform to U.S. policies, by armed invasions to limit or overthrow popular movements and governments, by supporting coups and military dictatorships which terrorized their populations. These events took place from the 19th century until the end of the 20th century, when the U.S. began imposing its control over these nations through neoliberal and free trade policies. These countries could not compete economically with the North American giant and its monopolies, which were able to take over land, factories, and natural resources. That is to say, the economic penetration was exerted even more forcefully than the coups and the invasions by U.S. troops. Let us remember some portions of these stories. At the end of the 19th century, when the pro-independence Cuban forces had practically defeated the Spanish colonial troops, against whom they had been fighting for more than a century and a half, the U.S. declared war on the debilitated Spanish Empire, invaded Cuba, and took over the island, relegating the Cuban troops, the Mambisas, to inferior status. At the same time, the U.S. was occupying Puerto Rico, where it still maintains neocolonial control. In 1959 in Cuba, a populist movement led by a rebel army took power and knocked down the dictatorship of Fulgencio Batista, who was supported by the United States. After this victory, Washington used all its powers to attack the new Cuban government led by Fidel Castro. Invasions by mercenaries, economic and commercial blockades, continuous terrorist attacks, assassination attempts against governmental figures, and other aggressive actions have constantly been carried out against Cuba from North American territory. Since 1912, the United States has invaded Nicaragua on three occasions. In 1954, the CIA, with the support of White House, of the White House, overthrew the government of Guatemala. In 1965, the United States invaded the Dominican Republic. In the 1970s, the United States supported military coups in Brazil, Uruguay, Argentina, Chile. Afterward, invaded Panama and the small island of Grenada, and thousands of civilians were killed. A complete list of actions directed by the United States in order to control Latin America would be nearly endless. While these activities were taking place, the majority of the population of Latin America tried to survive in the midst of the deepest poverty. Simultaneously, a small national bourgeoisie enjoyed power in the capitals as the natural wealth of their countries was transferred to the United States by transnational companies. These resources traveled towards North America at giveaway prices. Silver, gold, petrol, gas, sugar, and all kinds of fruits extracted from the Latin American earth. The exploitation of cheap labor allowed the United States to produce goods at low cost in Latin America and sell them at very profitable rates in the North American market. The United States saw the triumph of the Cuban Revolution as a very bad example, since Cuba, unlike the rest of the countries in the region, immediately rejected the orders coming from Washington. Cuba was raising the banners of sovereignty and political and economic independence, a situation which the United States could not allow. In order to keep the rest of Latin America from following Cuba's example, in 1961, President John F. Kennedy proposed an economic and social aid program for the whole region. This program was called the Alliance for Progress, and it proposed ways of improving the economic and social conditions of the impoverished peoples of Latin America. The Alliance for Progress became an absolute economic and social failure for the Latin American governments. But the United States achieved its aim. It isolated Cuba, although it could not destroy it as intended with the invasion of the Bay of Pigs ordered by President Kennedy himself. Since the 1960s, Washington put other plans in motion in order to keep hegemonic control over the region. And beginning in 1991, after the collapse of the socialist states of Europe and above all the old Soviet Union, the United States became the only political, military, and economic superpower in the world. The economical penetration in the Latin American region continued through the transnational companies and free trade treaties. The long crisis and the social cost of the neoliberal models applied in Latin America since the 1980s aggravated the profound drama of suffering in the region. By 1995, 110 million people of the region lived in extreme poverty, and 226 million lived on less than $2 per day, which was not even enough to feed themselves. At the Fourth Summit of the Americas, which took place in Mar del Plata, Argentina, in November 2005, a radical turn against the policies of economic submission took place. The majority of the countries attending rejected the project planned by the United States for the region, the Free Trade Agreement of the Americas, or the FTAA. The objective of FTAA was to maintain the levels of dependency in the region that guaranteed the appropriation of natural resources and the privatization of services and at the same time perpetuated U.S. control over the sovereignty of these nations. In one of his profound analyses, the Nobel Prize-winning economist Joseph Stiglitz indicated that even if the North American Free Trade Agreement, NAFTA, helped Mexico recover from the crisis of 1994-95, in later years, the benefits from opening its markets vanished. Currently, more than half of the people of Mexico live in poverty. According to Stiglitz, 53.3 million inhabitants out of a population of 104 million cannot satisfy their basic needs for food, education, health, housing, clothing, and transportation. All in all, the imposition of neoliberal policies provoked huge disparities in the economic fortunes of Latin American populations and highly accentuated unemployment and poverty. This gave rise to the emergence of national movements of emancipation. New voices rose up in favor of independence and political economic sovereignty in Latin America. As such countries as Venezuela, Bolivia, Ecuador, Nicaragua, Argentina, Brazil, Uruguay, Paraguay, and others from the Caribbean, together with Cuba, started to make themselves heard in national and international forums against neoliberal policies. For Latin American integration, it was completely necessary to confront the hegemonic policies that the USA had been applying in the region for decades. A fundamental turning point in this political reorientation was the electoral triumph of the Bolivarian president of Venezuela, Hugo Chavez, in 1999. In this manner, new organizations have arisen that, despite some defects, have succeeded in elaborating their own political, economic, and social programs. These are ALBA, the Grupo del Rio, Mercosur, which has become stronger, UNASUR, the Union of South American Nations, etc. With what we call the globalization of solidarity, many countries in the region managed in recent years to evade the catastrophe created by the high price of oil. These countries would not have been able to pay the high prices for oil without the help given by Venezuela, which sold fuel at subsidized prices. With the help of Cuba, thousands of doctors have worked in many countries of the region, offering free and sustained services as they attend to millions of people who never had access to health programs before. Similarly, thousands of students of Latin America in of the United States have received free medical education in Cuban and Venezuelan universities. Several Latin American governments have expanded their programs of public health care and education. Millions of people have learned to read and write thanks to the Cuban method Yo Si Puedo, and Venezuela, Bolivia, and Nicaragua have been declared as regions free of illiteracy by UNESCO. Poverty levels have been dramatically reduced in countries such as Venezuela, Bolivia, Nicaragua, Brazil, Argentina, and Ecuador after the implementation of public social policies. The words of former Brazilian President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva represent the feelings of many Latin Americans. Last December, before his administration came to an end, he regretted that Barack Obama was keeping the same approach as his predecessors towards Latin America. Lula asserted, and I quote, "In my opinion, the United States does not have a more optimistic vision toward Latin America and South America because there has always been a relationship of an empire with the poor countries." In conclusion, Latin America already is not the same as it was decades ago. And it is true that most countries have a pretty unfavorable view of the behavior of the U.S. in our region. However, it's also very true that every country, without exception, wants to maintain normal relations of economic, social exchange, and friendship with the giant of the North, but always with respect for their sovereignty and independence. It is necessary, then, for the United States to reinitiate relations of friendship, understanding, and assistance with Latin American nations in order to make this whole continent one of the most democratic, pacific, and advanced places in the entire world. And my question is, will it be possible for the United States to change its conception of Latin America as its backyard? Is it capable of accepting the existence of governments with their own national interests? Will it be able to accept the exercise of national sovereignty by Latin American nations? Will it be able to change its policy of embargo against Cuba? Will it control the brain drain of Latin Americans toward the United States so they can actually help their own countries to develop? And thank you very much for your attention. We're going to have a question and answer period now, but before that, Professor Rose has a brief announcement to make about an upcoming program that we're contemplating.
Okay. I can do that and maybe move into the first question then for Adalberto.
Okay.
I just wanted to announce, because we know some people may need to go at the end of the Q&A, Sinan and I will be offering a course, a globally integrated course next spring that will focus on Cuba and take a spring break trip to Cuba. It'll be 9 to 10 days. The course is going to be titled Sustainability and Resilience, Cuban Society and Economy. This will be the third time, I think, that we've co-taught this. And it was a period there where we weren't allowed to take student groups to Cuba. That has now opened up. So just to let you know, I'm actually on sabbatical, so I'm not really here this spring. Sinan is the one to talk with if you're interested. We'll be announcing this much more formally by early fall and then doing applications for the program then. And I guess I would also say the focus of the course and the spring break trip will be on sustainability, both in terms of cultural, social, and economic sustainability, as well as urban agriculture, with major focus on education and health and gender issues. Maybe I'll leave the first question then open it up, but I'll tie that in. So actually more educational groups are now going to be allowed into Cuba again. That's opening up.
Yeah.
And just interested, too, in Cuban perspectives on what may be an influx of Americans. You've always had lots of Europeans coming and others, but is there any concern in terms of the floodgates opening or not?
Está preguntando si...
Vamos a parar lo mejor para estar ahí.
Hay muchos grupos...
Si quieres, te puedes quedar, no,
no sé si yo
hay muchos grupos académicos que quieren ir a Cuba, y entonces te pregunta si hay alguna idea, algún parecer en el pueblo de Cuba con respecto
sí,
a ese movimiento hacia Cuba.
Sí. Actualmente, desde hace mucho tiempo, a Cuba le interesan los intercambios académicos entre las universidades y entre las organizaciones.
Yeah. Cuba is interested in all these exchanges, academic and different organizations.
Recientemente, bueno, ya estaba en una universidad y además en la organización de la juventud cubana y están preparando, están tratando de que estos intercambios se incrementen en lo más posible.
Mm-hmm. He has been in touch with Cuban universities and academic environments, and they are very much interested in establishing these exchanges.
Es decir, la juventud cubana quiere conocer tanto los intereses que hay de los estudiantes norteamericanos, de los profesores norteamericanos en cuanto a Cuba, de ese conocimiento, al igual que ellos quieren conocer acá cómo funciona la sociedad. Recientemente estuvieron aquí varios estudiantes cubanos en un recorrido que hicieron por muchas universidades, casi todo el país, y fue muy beneficioso porque fue un intercambio entre ellos muy, muy fuerte. Es beneficioso para los
The Cuban youth is interested in learning more about the view and the ideas that the U.S. People have concerning them, and they welcome all these exchanges. And recently, a group of Cuban students were traveling throughout the U.S. and getting to know people of their own age and their own situation in life, and it was very enriching.
Okay, next question.
Okay,
go ahead.
I have a couple of questions. Concerning the imperialistic foreign policy, do you think that might change as the U.S. becomes more Hispanic and as the U.S. becomes, as more immigration occurs? And my second question is, what do you think about the new Pacific Union that is being proposed, which will basically be much more, have much more privatization and much more neoliberal policies? And the only thing that seems to be getting in the way of this new Pacific Union is the possibility that Alvaro Humala might get elected in Peru, which would break this union, because then it would be Peru become more leftist. Do you think this new union might pose a challenge to ALBA, Mercosur, and other unions that are trying to stand up to the neoliberal ideology?
La primera pregunta es que a medida que los Estados Unidos se hispaniza, ¿piensas que sería Estados Unidos menos imperialista? Y la segunda pregunta tiene que ver con la Unión del Pacífico, que aparentemente va a tener mucha privatización y va a tener ingredientes que más bien pertenecen al capitalismo. Y
¿cuándo Unión del Pacífico va a tener?
It was in The Economist like the past week. It's going to be Chile, Peru, Colombia, and Mexico. Sí, sí.
Y entonces va a haber mucha privatización e ingredientes de un tipo económico distinto. La única cosa que podría ocurrir es que un candidato socialista en el Perú fue cuestionado.
Humala.
Que él pueda entrar entonces y obtener el control del Perú, y entonces el Perú se echaría hacia la izquierda. Y eso
la primera pregunta, ¿cuál es?
Que a medida que se hispaniza Estados Unidos, Estados Unidos podría ser menos imperialista.
Mira, es que la concepción de Estados Unidos es la de ser un imperio. Es muy difícil cambiar esa ideología si no se cambian las relaciones de intercambio entre los países.
Yeah.
Si entran más hispanos, no tiene nada que ver que a veces entren hispanos, porque pueden ser hispanos que defiendan estas ideas de derecha, ¿no? Porque vamos a suponer, ahora está Micheletti en Honduras, está en Panamá, otro está en Chile, como tú dices, un gobierno de derecha, está en Colombia más o menos un gobierno de derecha que va a hacer un tratado de libre comercio que va a perjudicar por completo a Colombia, es decir, lo va a perjudicar aún más. Pero es muy difícil que Estados Unidos cambie su política así mientras no haya una idea de que las relaciones deben ser normales y que me debe respetar a los países de América Latina.
The U.S. is by nature imperialistic. It's an empire. So the influx of Hispanics does not necessarily mean that conception of the U.S. is going to change. You can have Hispanics coming into the U.S. that are going to side or sympathize with the imperialistic conception. You know, I think like his compatriots, you know, in Miami. You know. And the second thing is that you have countries in Latin America like Chile or Colombia who have established good relations with the U.S. and who do not necessarily reject in a very open way this imperialistic attitude. The case of Colombia, for instance, which is making now a special agreement with the U.S. that is not going to be good for Colombia.
Pero es muy importante esta elección que va a ocurrir en Perú, porque Ollantumala mantiene una política mucho más a favor del pueblo. Es decir, en Perú prácticamente el 50% de la población es pobre y está en la pobreza total, sobre todo la parte de los indios, que le llaman, es decir, la civilización india que hay en Perú.
En Perú, with the possible new president, things could change. He could probably do some social changes that would make progress for the people that are downtrodden. About 50% of the population is in poverty, and most of them are of Indian descent. You know, the original
Indians.
En estos países, la mayoría de la población no va a votar. En primera, porque no sabe, y en segunda, porque está aburrido de que los gobiernos pasen uno tras otro y no resuelvan sus problemas.
Most of the population will not vote because they do not know much about it, and because they are tired of one government after another without solving anything.
Eso pasó con Ollanta Humala en la anterior ocasión, cuando Adán García logró la presidencia, a pesar de que Ollanta había ganado la primera elección, pero todas las organizaciones, los partidos de derecha se unieron para derrotarlo. Yo creo que en esta ocasión no va a ocurrir, porque no quieren a Fujimori. Es decir, Keiko Fujimori representa la dictadura de Fujimori. Y por lo tanto, hasta un hombre de derecha, como es Mario Vargas Llosa, ayer acaba de decir que Ollanta Humala es menos malo que lo que puede hacer Fujimori y puede ser que le den el apoyo. Yo creo, si eso ocurre en el Pacífico, va a ser muy importante, porque es otro país más que se une a esta integración del ALBA y del...
Let me see if I can get this part. apparently...
Más sintético. Es decir, pienso que en esta ocasión puede ser que Ollanta Humala gane las elecciones.
Ollanta Humala could win the elections.
Porque hasta un hombre de derecha como Mario Vargas Llosa acaba de decir que Keiko Fujimori representa la dictadura anterior de su padre y que es menos malo Ollanta Humala que Keiko Fujimori.
Yeah, the writer Vargas Llosa says that Humala would be better than Fujimori, Keiko Fujimori, because Fujimori represents the dictatorship of the other Fujimori.
Y a pesar de que Obama, voy a decir, que gane las elecciones de Obama, va a estar de todas maneras medio controlado por por el Tratado de Libre Comercio.
Yeah.
Es decir, está atado con Estados Unidos por el Tratado de Libre Comercio, pero va a tener una política un poco más independiente y puede unirse a estos movimientos democráticos que hay en América Latina.
Although Humala could win, he would be controlled by certain treatises, economic treatises. But even though that control would exist, he would be capable of doing some changes and improving the circumstances.
Okay, next question. Yes.
Sí, hacia el final de su ponencia expresó un deseo de hemisférico, de que este hemisferio sea como un modelo de democracia, y comparto ese deseo, por supuesto. Mi pregunta tiene que ver con la relación entre la democracia y el respeto por los derechos humanos. En Cuba, desde hace mucho, el gobierno cubano rechaza los informes anuales de Amnistía Internacional, según lo que leo, por un lado, pero por otro lado, no responde el gobierno a las peticiones anuales de amnistía para hacer su trabajo en Cuba. Entonces, mi pregunta es: ¿cómo se explica eso? Y no es cierto que en ningún país se puede fiar de un gobierno de ser el que vigila por los derechos humanos.
Professor Aldrich is asking about human rights. And that Cuba frequently has ignored Amnesty International and that it has not paid attention to the reports that come from Amnesty International. And Professor Aldrich finishes saying that it is very difficult to conceive of a country that has a government that decides what human rights there are for the rest of the population. And he empathizes with the comment that Edelberto made concerning, you know, a continent of democracy and good understanding.
Sí, hay que partir en primera que Amnistía Internacional es una organización mayormente de derecha que cuando hay gobiernos un poco de izquierda va en contra de ellos, es decir, ¿no?
Bueno, acaban de dar uno de sus honores máximos a uno de los grandes amigos de Cuba, que es el profesor Noam Chomsky.
Ajá.
Así que no sé cómo podemos
decir
que este derecho...
Bueno, es que mayormente ha ido, tradicionalmente, desde su fundación, siempre han atacado los derechos humanos. Hay que verlo de qué forma de democracia tú quieres. Es decir, si es la democracia de Occidente o es la democracia de los países que están en desarrollo. Hay que partir de ahí. Si yo
Amnesty International tends to be a rightist organization, and it doesn't have high regards for leftist governments. Although Noam Chomsky, who is a friend of Cuba, was honored by Amnesty International recently. So it depends on what type of democracy do you want. If you want the model for a country like the US, or if you want a model that would be more in tune with developing countries.
Es la forma de presentar la realidad. Te pongo un ejemplo. Zamora es un preso común en Cuba. Robó, atacó, apuñaló a una persona y empezaron a levantarlo. Lo convirtieron en una estatua de la libertad en Cuba. Le empezaron a dar dinero. Murió en la cárcel haciendo una huelga de hambre. Pero era un preso común, no era un preso político.
Era un preso común según el gobierno cubano.
Pero si tú lo coges preso porque robó y porque apuñaló a alguien, no es un preso. Además, no sabía nada de política. Absolutamente nada de política.
Okay.
This person, Zamora, was a common prisoner in Cuba, in jail, and he was apparently a person that stole, he attacked people, he stabbed people, and his image was lifted, you know, was brought up by various interests from the outside, and he died in jail in a hunger strike. But he was not a political prisoner, apparently, he was just a common prisoner.
Después de eso lo hace un prisionero político. Le entregan dinero a él, a la familia, y después toda la familia ha venido para acá.
Es igual con por ejemplo, con Darcy Ferrer. Es igual, el caso de Darcy Ferrer.
Bueno, es que yo no conozco todos estos problemas en Cuba, ¿no? ¿No? Yo soy periodista simplemente que me encargo de las cosas, relaciones internacionales. Sí, no.
Es bastante sonado. En todo caso, si todo está tan bien...
No, todos están bien. No, hay que arreglar muchas cosas. En Cuba hay que arreglar muchas cosas. Sí. Se están tratando de arreglar.
¿No sería bueno tener Amnistía Internacional?
No, sería mejor otros organismos más democráticos que Amnistía Internacional. Yo pienso que deben ser organismos de América Latina mismo que reúnen eso o que vean eso. Es decir, organismos nuestros, que los formemos nosotros, no que vengan de Estados Unidos o de otras partes. Es decir, organismos de América Latina que se encarguen de ver esas cosas, los problemas democrático que pueda haber en un país.
Traducción.
This person Zamora began to receive money and he was, as I said before, elevated. There are other people apparently that and one professor Aldrich mentioned that are political prisoners. Alberto answered by saying, "Well, I do not know all these cases. This is not my field." But it is important to have, for countries to have the right to develop their own systems, their own institutions, to evaluate human rights, that human rights should not be imposed by foreign organizations that represent other interests, like Amnesty International, which is not a Cuban organization. So it is a problem of whether you are going to accept what comes from the outside, or if the conflict itself can generate its own institutions for evaluating human rights.
Son muchas las cuestiones. Y es que Cuba ha estado tan atacado durante más de 50 y pico años que ha tenido que reforzarse, por lo menos, tratar de hacer un escudo. Yo creo que el día que Estados Unidos esté de acuerdo en levantar este bloqueo, de tratar las relaciones no solamente con Cuba, sino con América Latina, de forma más democrática, de democracia real, se podrían hacer muchas cosas más. Y se pueden hacer este intercambio de organizaciones. Allá ha ido el FBI y ha estado en colaboración con el gobierno cubano y se le entregaron hasta informes de gente que había ido allá y había puesto bombas en el país y no hicieron nada. Es decir, al mismo...
Ah, okay, traducción, traducción.
Es que una...
pero bueno...
Se me olvidó por dónde empezar. Cuba has had to create a shield because it has been, they have been attacked for over 50 years. They have been in this hostility. So Cuba has had to create a shield, a wall, in order to protect itself. The fact that it has had to do that has produced tremendous problems for the country. Cuba has to change many things, but it has to also protect its circumstances and its situation. It has always collaborated. The FBI has been in Cuba, and Cuba has given information, important information, to the FBI concerning people that have gone to the country to put bombs and to do terroristic activities, and the FBI has done nothing. So it is important for the U.S. and, you know, to create a system that would be truly democratic, that would be a system that could be truly democratic not only with Cuba, but also with the countries of Latin America.
Siempre ha habido una excusa para acusar a Cuba.
There has always been an excuse to accuse Cuba.
En los primeros años era que Cuba exportaba la revolución a América Latina y a otros lados.
Yeah, in the first years of the revolution, it was that Cuba was exporting the revolution to other places in Latin
America. Estados Unidos decía, cuando Cuba deje de exportar la revolución, vamos a levantar el embargo, que es un bloqueo.
The U.S. would say that whenever Cuba would stop exporting the revolution, then the U.S. would stop the embargo or this blockade.
Cuando Cuba fue a ayudar a África, Angola específicamente, cuando hubo la guerra, decían que Estados Unidos levantaría el bloqueo cuando Cuba saliera de África.
When Cuba went to help the African nations, especially Angola, the U.S. said that they would lift the embargo, the blockade, when Cuba would leave Africa.
Y ahora dicen que levantarán el bloqueo cuando Cuba ejerza de verdad los derechos humanos.
And now they say that the blockade or embargo would be lifted when Cuba truly practices human rights.
Y pienso que en el futuro dirán que levantarán el bloqueo cuando mueran todas las personas en Cuba y puedan ir otra vez.
¿Qué personas?
Sí, las personas en Cuba, los dirigentes, todo el mundo.
Yeah. Well, and then he thinks that the next comment would be whenever all the people that participated in the revolution, you know, people that have been associated with the revolution.
El problema es que duele contrarrestar a Estados Unidos. Es decir, una potencia, y si yo te digo que eres una potencia y que eres malo, y lo dices y lo anuncias y lo planteas en Naciones Unidas, es un problema. Siempre vas a ser el perdedor, y cuando tienes un país tan pequeño, es muy difícil.
It is very difficult for a small country to contradict a powerful country and call that the other country has is producing negative or evil situations for the smaller country.
Another question.
Other question?
Yes.
Refería usted un poco al sueño americano, y yo me interesa si hay también un sueño común de Cuba que se puede explicar.
She's asking about the possibility that, as you know, that you have here in the USA an American dream. Is there something like a Cuban dream for the Cuba?
Hey. El sueño americano es venir y hacerse rico acá, tener casa, tener carro. Es decir, es el sueño americano de los inmigrantes, mayormente, que vienen a este país.
Yeah, the American dream for immigrants is wealth, be rich.
El sueño cubano es tener resueltos los problemas fundamentales de toda la población y tener relaciones de interrelación con todos los países del mundo. Es decir, aunque tenga otro sistema de gobierno, aunque tenga otro criterio, pero que sí podamos compartir con todo el mundo a la misma vez y ayudar a los países más pobres, es decir, a los países que tienen menos.
The Cuban dream is more modest. It is simply to be able to
fulfill, to cover the basic needs of the population, and at the same time to have good relations with other countries in the world, with everybody, and at the same time to be capable of helping those countries that are in need.
Another question?
On the trade. I want to link it to the class that's going to happen a year from now, the issue of sustainability and the environment in particular the environment. I know that's not his field, but since environmental issues tend to transcend political boundaries, do you think that there is a possibility of collaboration? ¿Hay posibilidades de colaboración a través de las políticas ambientales que tienden a trascender lo político, la diferencia ideológica? ¿Podría haber ahí una posibilidad?
Sería lo más importante, porque el mundo como está va a desaparecer. Es decir, se está atacando al ambiente, al medio ambiente, y están sucediendo hechos como nunca habían sucedido en el mundo.
Yeah, the environment is going to suffer very much and it might disappear because the events that we have witnessed in recent times have never been witnessed before. He believes also that the cooperation of environmental cooperation is possible and it will bring countries together.
Es decir, están desapareciendo los hielos en el Ártico, están ocurriendo terremotos en Japón, en Haití, en Chile. Inundaciones enormes.
Me voy a interrumpir, pero no el Ártico, el Caribe.
El Caribe, el Caribe, el Caribe hay una gran relación de Cuba con de todo lo que tiene que ver con el medio ambiente. Hay una colaboración estrecha tratando de resolver sobre todo los efectos de los gases estos que desbaratan la atmósfera. En América Latina también se está logrando esto, se está logrando con China un poco, porque China quiere ese desarrollo tan inmenso, y no voy a hablar más de China porque ya sé que quiere el Caribe, pero bueno, hay un intercambio muy, muy grande entre Cuba y América Latina en esto, es decir, allá en Cuba se está haciendo, no campaña, sino se está dando mucha divulgación de los problemas que traen estos problemas medioambientales.
Mm-hmm. Cuba is very much involved with environmental problems and in the Caribbean and in general, and I think the same process is taking place in Latin America. So this is something that is quite important for the Cuban reality and also the Latin American reality.
Cada vez que hay un encuentro en América Latina, lo primero que se habla es sobre el medio ambiente.
When they have meetings, the first thing that is done is to discuss the environment.
Y ahí está. Ajá.
So I believe that the revolution was very positive for Cuba. It brought about a very high level of literacy, universal education for all peoples up through college, if they so choose. It brought about a infant mortality rate that is as good or exceeds our own. Longevity as well, and healthcare for all of the population. My question really is, do you think that the embargo from the U.S. actually helped sustain the revolution through these last 50 years so that there wasn't as much likelihood of U.S. Influence both economically and militarily over the last 50 years? That in fact, although Cuba was isolated, they had a chance to develop this type of high quality society for their people with these kinds of services.
And coming to their urban agriculture too.
El embargo ha sido... El embargo contra Cuba ha sido criminal, sobre todo contra la población cubana, es decir, contra el pueblo cubano. Pero a pesar de todo este embargo, que no podemos ir a comprar una medicina, es decir, Cuba no puede ir a comprar una medicina a Estados Unidos, donde la hay, se ha buscado la forma y no se ha dejado de atender a la población. ni en la educación ni en la salud.
The embargo has been criminal, but even with those difficulties, the Cuban people have been able to survive. If you need a medicine and you cannot go and get it, you know, from the U.S., for the Cuban people, Cuba has been able to find other ways of getting that medicine.
Las medicinas son muy caras, y los tratamientos contra el cáncer son muy, pero muy, muy caros. Hay niños en el hospital, hay muchos hospitales, como ustedes sabrán, en todas las provincias hay varios hospitales. Una pastilla, solamente una pastilla contra el cáncer cuesta $500. Y una inyección contra el cáncer vale $1,000+. Cuba lo ha resuelto en Europa o en otras partes donde no tiene. Cuba también tiene centros de investigaciones que hacen medicinas contra el cáncer, pero hay cosas específicas de otros tipos de cáncer que tienen que resolverse. Y tenemos muchos niños que tienen que sufrir este embargo porque Estados Unidos no nos deja comprar aquí en Estados Unidos. Y hay que ir a buscar mucho más caro a otros países, tanto Japón, Asia o Europa, para darle esos medicamentos que nunca le han faltado. Es decir, Cuba se ha sacrificado, podemos a lo mejor tener menos carros, okay, menos okay, cosas, pero...
No me acuerdo. The medicine sometimes can be very expensive. It would be cheaper for the Cubans to get them from the U.S. Since they cannot get it from the U.S., they have to go to Europe, and that is part of the expense. For example, in Cuba, you have many hospitals. Every province has various hospitals. And children that are sick, you know, they have cancer, if they need a particular pill, the pill is $500. If they need an injection, it's over $1,000. But even though those expenses have been tremendous, they have been able to provide for the population. It has never been something that they didn't have. They have even gone to Asia, Japan and different places in Asia to obtain the medicines that they needed.
Y eso mismo ha pasado con la educación, con todo. Es decir, se han mantenido todas las escuelas abiertas, con los niños, con sus uniformes, normalmente, es decir, a pesar de todo este dolor.
And even though the embargo has existed, education has not been affected. Like medicine, education has not been affected by...
I don't know, I answered your question.
Yeah, my question really is, do you believe that if there had been the normal interchange between Cuba and the U.S. since 1960, starting, that economically enmeshed with the United States, would Cuba have, I know that it's more difficult for Cuba, but if Cuba had allowed, if there had been no embargo, would the influence of the United States just simply sort of gotten so enmeshed in Cuba that in fact the society, the Cuban Revolution would have not been able to succeed in areas, in the areas that it did, healthcare, education,
Lo que te pregunta es que, ¿qué piensas tú? ¿Ha sido el embargo una especie de protección para Cuba que ha permitido que los cubanos desarrollaran esto en vez de tener más influencia de Estados Unidos por medio de la interacción y el intercambio? Sí, claro. O sea que el embargo paradójicamente ha servido de protección.
Ha sido así. El embargo ha servido de protección para muchas cosas. Si yo tengo una relación normal con Estados Unidos, yo no puedo decir el imperialismo es malo, ustedes me están atacando, pero hay muchas maneras de resolverlo. Mientras que con eso también ha sido una forma de reeducar a la población, pero además servir de escudo contra muchas cosas, otras cosas que podrían venir de Estados Unidos. Es decir, la influencia de un capital exagerado, de una riqueza exagerada, eso ha servido también de influencia como un resguardo.
Yeah, the embargo has been protective. You know, it has been paradoxical. It has helped Cuba to protect itself. It makes it easier because you could have a tremendous capital flow from the U.S. that would change radically some of the things that the revolution has established or was trying to establish.
I think maybe we'll take one more question. Final question from somebody.
Coming back to the environment.
It's better that you are speaking in Mexican.
Te voy a hablar en español. Pero vamos a
un caso específico y solamente por curiosidad, ¿no? Cuando hubo el derrame de petróleo en el Golfo, o sea, hace que el año pasado o algo así, ¿no? Y que se puso muy caro, en ese momento, y es cosa que uno ignora si estando acá, ¿no? ¿Hubo comunicación, un intercambio o algo entre Cuba y los Estados Unidos para poder poner un plan en efecto para ayudar a limpiar esto o para prevenir cualquier daño a Cuba? ¿Hubo algo así?
Constantemente eran los intercambios. Estados Unidos decía, bueno, no sé si va a hacer la diferencia.
Professor Quintanar was asking whether, when, you know, whether was any communication of Cuba and the U.S. During the moment in last year when we had the oil spill in the Gulf, no? BP's oil spill, was there any communication?
Es decir, mira, cuando a Estados Unidos le conviene algo, trata de hacer este intercambio con Cuba. Lo ha hecho con la inmigración, lo ha hecho con la droga, porque en Cuba cada vez que hay un barco esto de la droga, se atrapa y se le dan hasta las líneas por donde vienen esas drogas. Con la inmigración sucede lo mismo y con lo del petróleo sucedió lo mismo.
Yeah, whenever the United States is interested in something, it collaborates with Cuba. It has done it with immigration, and it has done it also with the case, in the case of oil.
Terrorism.
Also.
Y con el petróleo, todos los días, la sección, a través de la sección de intereses, llegaba la nota cómo se estaba resolviendo el petróleo, los problemas petroleros, porque estaba cerca de las costas cubanas y podía llegar, según el oleaje, podía llegar hacia Cuba o seguir hacia el Golfo. Y era constante la información que daba Estados Unidos a Cuba sobre ese aspecto.
Yeah. In the middle of all this oil spill, the U.S. was giving very frequently information to the Cuban government because the oil came fairly close to Cuba and depending on the waves, the oil could be pushed into the Cuban shore.
Ahora, Cuba sabe que en el Golfo, en la parte de Cuba, hay bastante petróleo. Y ya los cubanoamericanos están tratando de meter leyes dentro del Congreso para que Cuba se le imposibilite perforar y obtener el petróleo, que es prácticamente una forma de vida más grande para Cuba.
Apparently in the Gulf, Cuba has oil. And residents, Cuban residents in the U.S. are trying to introduce in Congress some laws that would not facilitate Cuban exploitation of the oil. And this oil could mean quite a lot for the Cuban economy and the Cuban way of life.
Claro, el gobierno norteamericano no ha dicho nada de esto porque además ya empezaron otra vez a perforar en el Golfo otras compañías, a pesar de todo el desastre que hubo. Es decir, no ha dicho nada de que Cuba no pueda perforar. Además, una parte de Cuba no tiene por qué meterse.
The U.S. government hasn't said anything, although other companies have begun to look for oil in the Gulf. Anyway, the reality is that the oil is in Cuban territory, in the Cuban waters, and that the U.S. has nothing to do with the Cuban waters.
All right, we've got to terminate now, but before I do, I want to put in one editorial comment since the environment came up. Cuba is the only country that I know of that has in its governmental structure a ministry called Ciencia, Tecnología y Medio Ambiente. Ministry is science, technology, and environment ministry together, all three things together in one ministry. So I know of no other country that does that. So they take environment very seriously and pay attention to it. The point I'm making, I guess. Yeah.
And also, Edelbert and I are going over to the quarry. We're shifting a little bit. So anyone who would like to join us at the quarry, treats on CSC for coffee or dessert if you haven't had lunch. Okay. So if you'd like to continue the conversation, feel free to join us.
All right. So let's thank Edelbert.